Good morning. This is the BBC World News for the 10th of April, 2026, read by Steve Hoff. Well, we start today with the U.S. and Canada. First headline, U.S. inflation jumps to highest level in almost 2 years. Inflation in the U.S. accelerated last month to its highest rate in nearly 2 years as surging oil prices triggered by the U.S.-Israel war in Iran started to spill over into the wider economy. Consumer prices climbed to 3.3% over the 12-month to March, picking up from 2.4 in February, the Labor Department reported. The jump, which was expected, marked the biggest monthly change since 2022, when the world was dealing with an energy shock brought on by the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Last month's increase was driven by a surge in prices at the pump as the war shut down the Strait of Hormuz sent oil prices soaring. Gas prices rose 21.2% from February to March, the biggest monthly increase since the government started tracking the figures in 1967. Prices for fuel oil jumped more than 30% in the biggest surge since February of 2000. The impact has been particularly visible in states such as California, where gas prices were already higher than the rest of the United States. On Thursday, the average cost of gas a gallon of gas in California was $5.93 compared to nationwide average of $4.16. The spike in gas prices accounted for nearly three quarters of the rise in inflation from February to March. Prices for airline tickets and clothing also increased over the month, reflecting a mix of higher energy prices and the lingering impact of tariffs as firms continued to pass those costs on to consumers. Food prices were unchanged from February to March, but analysts said those may raise in the months ahead, as the impact of higher transportation and fertilizer costs start to be felt. The Strait of Hormuz is a critical passage for commodities such as natural gas, fertilizer, aluminum, and helium, as well as oil. While talks between the U.S. and Iran have raised hopes that the waterway would reopen to ship traffic, analysts have warned that it may take time for energy supplies to normalize. Oil prices have retreated from their recent highs, but remain significantly higher than before the conflict. Analysts said they took heart from the fact that the so-called core inflation was slightly more muted than expected, rising 2.6%. Core inflation is considered a better measure of underlying trends because it does not include food and energy prices, which tend to fluctuate. Categories that have seen prices fall over the past year include medicine and used cars and trucks. Still, the situation has dashed the hopes of many on Wall Street that the U.S. Central Bank might lower interest rates this year. Transitory is the hope, but Fed officials will think twice before telling the public they expect inflation to be transitory. After having misjudged post-pandemic inflation and mislabeled it as such. Next, Melania Trump denies ties to Jeffrey Epstein and urges hearings for the survivors. In a surprise announcement on Thursday, the First Lady called for congressional hearings for survivors of Epstein's sex trafficking. She also denied online rumors that Epstein introduced her to Donald Trump, calling them, quote, mean-spirited attempts to defame my reputation. It is unclear what prompted the announcement. The intervention has produced a mixed response from Epstein survivors. One survivor, Lisa Phillips, described the statement as a bold move, quote unquote, but questioned what more the First Lady could do to support Epstein accusers. There was no prior indication from her office that she would make a statement on Epstein, and the White House did not share the topic earlier when her remarks were put on the daily schedule. The president told news outlets MS Now he did not know about his wife's statement ahead of time. Meanwhile, the New York Times quoted a spokesperson for Melania Trump as saying the president knew that the First Lady planned to make a statement, but later said it was unclear if he was aware of the topic of the remarks. Melania Trump said she had not been a victim of Epstein, with whom she only briefly, quote, crossed paths in the 2000. I have never had any knowledge of Epstein's abuse of his victims, she said. I was never involved in any capacity. I was not a participant. She also denied knowing Ghislaine Maxwell, the disgraced financier's jailed associate. She referred to a 2002 email between her and Maxwell, released in the Epstein files, calling it nothing more than, quote, a casual correspondence and a polite reply. An email that appears to be the one she referenced is addressed to G, presumably Ghislaine, and includes compliments about a story featuring J.E., Jeffrey Epstein, with a photograph of G that appeared in New York Magazine. She wrote that she, quote, cannot wait to go to Palm Beach. Quote, give me a call when you are back in New York, the email says. Have a great time. Love, Melania. The New York Magazine article included quotes from now President Trump calling Epstein, quote, a terrific guy, and saying he's a lot of fun to be with. Melania Trump on Thursday additionally called on lawmakers to, quote, give these victims their opportunity to testify under oath in front of Congress with the power of sworn testimony, end quote. Each and every woman should have their day to tell her story in public if she wishes, and then her testimony should be permanently entered into the congressional record, she said. Then, and only then, we will have the truth. Several prominent business leaders have been forced to resign their positions in recent months after new details emerged about their ties to Epstein, a fact that Melania Trump referenced in her remarks. Of course, this does not amount to guilt, but we still must work openly and transparently to uncover the truth, she said. She did not take questions from reporters. In a statement published soon after she spoke, California Representative Robert Garcia, the most powerful Democrat on the House Oversight Committee, said that we agree with Melania's call for a public hearing. He urged the committee chairman, Republican Representative James Comer, to respond to the First Lady's request and schedule a public hearing immediately. Her statement at the White House is an extremely rare appearance by this First Lady, one of only a handful of similar events for the First Lady who has proven both elusive and influential since her husband returned to the White House. The First Lady's statement is likely to reignite intense public debate over the handling of the Justice Department's investigation into Epstein and the subsequent release of its files. Next, the Artemis crew returning to Earth with, quote, all the good stuff from moon discoveries. The Artemis II crew said they have many more pictures and many more stories to share with the world as they prepare to return to Earth. The four astronauts on board the Orion spacecraft have completed their mission around the moon and are expected to splash down off the coast of San Diego on Friday around 20 hours Friday. I heard just on the news that it was going to be around 5 o'clock. Oh, yeah. That's Eastern Standard Time, so out in San Diego, it would be 6 o'clock. Speaking to the media from space on their way home, the mission's pilot, Victor Glover, said the crew was eager to share what they had seen with the world. When asked during Wednesday's evening conference about re-entry to Earth, Glover said, "We have to get back. There's so much data that you've already seen, but all the good stuff is coming back with us. There's so many more pictures, so many more stories," he said. Glover added that the crew still had 2 more days before they could begin to process what they had been through. "I'm going to be thinking about and talking about all these things for the rest of my life," he said. The Artemis II mission spacecraft, Orion, broke the record for human travel at about 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on Monday, beating a record 248,655 miles held since 1970 by the Apollo 13 mission. The spacecraft was not planning to land on the moon, but fly around it, its far side, the side which is never visible from Earth. Satellites have photographed the far side before, but the astronauts were the first human eyes to see some parts of the far side's surface and its vast craters and lava plains. Straight after the flyby, President Trump spoke with the Orion team and congratulated them. Quote, "Today you've made history and made all America really proud, incredibly proud," end quote. During the most recent virtual news conference at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, the four astronauts once again beamed into a live stream as a microphone floated between them. They each took turns answering questions from reporters with considerable delays. The crew was asked by Los Angeles Times about the 40 minutes of profound solitude when they lost contact with Earth. Commander Reed Wiseman said the crew had a lot of scientific work to do, and it was probably, quote, probably the most critical lunar observations for our geological team, end quote. But the four of us took a moment. We shared maple cookies that Jeremy had brought, and we took about 3 or 4 minutes just as the crew to really reflect on where we were. For Glover, the greatest gift of the mission was seeing the lunar eclipse from beyond the far side of the moon. For Wiseman, the pinnacle moment was when his team named a lunar crater after Wiseman's late wife, Carol, who died of cancer in 2020. I think when Jeremy spelled out Carol's name, I think for me that was when I was overwhelmed with emotion and I looked over and Christina was crying, Reed said. Just for me personally, that was kind of a pinnacle moment of the mission for me. The crew also said that they were getting their source of news from planet Earth from their family members. They have been our source for how the mission is going from a public perspective, Wiseman said, before adding, obviously, they're all biased. When asked by the BBC's news science editor, Rebecca Morell, what the crew will miss most about being in space, Christina Nock said she will miss the camaraderie. On what she won't miss, Koch said, there wasn't anything. We can't explore deeper unless we do a few things that are inconvenient, unless we're making a few sacrifices, unless we're taking a few risks, and those things are all worth it. Next, the U.S. refinery now processing Venezuelan oil. The Minerva Gloria is docked at a wharf in the Mississippi Sound, not far from the U.S.'s vast oil reserves in the Gulf of Mexico. The ship, 820 feet long, painted navy and burgundy, is carrying precious cargo from Venezuela that just 6 months ago would have been impossible to bring to the U.S. 400,000 barrels of crude oil. Venezuela has the world's largest oil reserves. Under Venezuela's former president, Nicolas Maduro, oil exports had dropped significantly due to a lack of investment. Then came the U.S. sanctions against any imports from the Latin American country. But U.S. President Donald Trump vowed to tap those reserves after the U.S. military captured Maduro in a surprise nighttime raid in January. Now the oil is flowing again in Venezuela. In March, the country's monthly crude exports surpassed 1 million barrels per day, the first time since September. As the world reels from the impact of global energy prices caused by Iran blocking the Strait of Hormuz, big oil and gas companies like Chevron are now importing Venezuelan oil by the shipload. It's a big day not only for Chevron, but the entire Gulf region, said Tim Potter. He is director of Chevron's oil refinery in Pascagoula, Mississippi, the company's largest operation in the U.S. It is also the only U.S. oil company currently operating in Venezuela. Together, this means that Chevron can extract its own Venezuelan oil, process it, and get it directly to U.S. consumers. Venezuelan oil is relatively cheap to buy because it is much more difficult to process. It is very heavy, thick, dark, and high in sulfur, often called a sour oil. It is used to make diesel, gasoline, jet fuel, and other products. Chevron now imports the equivalent of 250,000 barrels of Venezuelan crude oil per day on average. We think we can take that up another 50% to around 350,000 to 400,000 barrels a day of just Chevron's share of our position in Venezuela. Chevron is also not the only player when it comes to oil refining in the United States. There are 132 refineries in the U.S. that run on a mix of crude oils, and nearly 70% of U.S. refining capacity runs almost exclusively with heavier crude. The U.S. imports very little oil from the Middle East, roughly only 8% in 2025. The increase in imports from Venezuela means there is more oil available, which should translate to cheaper gasoline prices for U.S. drivers. And now a headline from north of the border. Canada's carney welcomes another defector to Liberals as he nears a majority. A Conservative member of Parliament from Ontario has defected to the Liberal Party, bringing Canada's Prime Minister, Mark Carney, inches away from leading a majority in the House of Commons. Marilyn Gadu announced her switch this week, saying the community she represents wants, quote, serious leadership and a real plan to build a stronger and more independent Canadian economy. The fifth MP to leave their party in recent months, Gadu has brought a majority government within arm's reach for the Liberals. They now have 171 seats, one shy of the required 172 for a majority. Canada's Conservative leader, Pierre Poilievre, has accused Carney of trying to seize a majority, quote, through dirty backroom deals. Last month, MP Lori Eidlaud, who represents Nunavut, left the New Democratic Party to join Carney's caucus. That followed the defections of three Conservative MPs, Matt Généraux of Alberta, Chris D'Entremont of Nova Scotia, and Michael Ma of Ontario. Quote, in a time of global economic uncertainty, Canada's success will depend on how we build ambition into progress and strengths into sustained advantage, Carney posted on social media. But the conservative Poilievre urged Godeau to face voters in a by-election and give the voters a final say. Quote, when a member of parliament goes back on the word they made to their constituents and switches parties, constituents should be able to petition to throw them out and have a by-election, he said during a news conference on Thursday. That would put the people back in charge of our democracy rather than having dirty backroom deals, end quote. He also argued that Mark Carney is saying to Canadians, your vote does not count. I feel badly for Ms. Godeau's constituents, the strong majority of whom voted for our conservative vision. Godeau ran in 2020 for leadership of the Conservatives, but withdrew from the race not long after launching her campaign. Godeau, who represents the Sarnia-Lambton in Ontario, said on Wednesday her choice was, quote, the best thing for our community priorities and, importantly, for our country. The area she represents sits right on the U.S. border. And in her announcement, she alluded to working to build a more independent Canada. We need a global leader with a plan to make a more resilient Canada, she said in a video standing next to Carney. On Thursday, Carney said she would vote with the party on matters regarding LGBT and abortion rights. It comes amid criticism of her conservative record in Parliament, including her stance on COVID vaccines, the legalization of cannabis, and the conversion therapy for teens. Moving on to the UK, the first headline, we should not be at the mercy of events abroad. That's from Starmer. The UK must become more resilient to deal with, quote, volatile and dangerous world where shocks like the conflict in Iran are frequent, the Prime Minister has warned. Writing in The Guardian, Sir Keir Starmer said he was, quote, thinking about the long term and remaking this country so that people, quote, are not at the mercy of events abroad. Separately, he told the ITV's Talking Politics podcast he was, quote, fed up with the fact that families across the country see their bills go up and down because of actions of Putin or Trump. The Prime Minister is currently on a 3-day trip to the Gulf to meet regional allies. On Wednesday, he met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in Jeddah, and on Thursday, he traveled to the UAE, Bahrain, and Qatar. His visit comes as a fragile ceasefire pausing the Iranian conflict has come under strain, with disagreements over whether the truce covers Lebanon. On Thursday evening, Sir Keir held a phone call with U.S. President Donald Trump. Downing Street says the two men discussed the need, quote, for a practical plan to get shipping moving through the Strait of Hormuz, the shipping lane that has been effectively closed as a result of the conflict. The closure of the strait has had an impact on the cost of living in the UK, with petrol and food prices being driven up. Speaking to the Talking Politics, I think that's a podcast, Sir Kerr said the events of the past 2 months have demonstrated why the UK needed to have, quote, energy independence. In his article for the Guardian newspaper, Sir Kerr said Britain had been buffeted by crisis for nearly two decades, citing the 2008 financial crash, Brexit, and COVID. The response from Westminster has always been the same. Manage the crisis, find a sticking plaster, and then desperately try to reassert the status quo. He promised that this time it will be different, and that the conflict in Iran must now become a line in the sand. He argued that the government policies, such as investing in renewable energy, strengthening workers' rights, and removing the two-child benefit cap, would help prepare the country for increased global instability, because resilience is what gives us control. Without it, we are constantly pushed off course by events beyond our borders. Given the Mansion House speech in central London, Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper echoed the Prime Minister's sentiments. It might be tempting, even comforting, to think that the Iran crisis is a once-in-a-generation shock. But this is the third time in 6 years that international events have sent economic tidal waves around the globe, hitting Britain's shores, the COVID pandemic, the invasion of Ukraine, and now the Iranian conflict. Instability and volatility are becoming increasingly chronic, and turbulence is the new normal. The new reality we face did not begin with the war in Iran, nor will it end with a reopened strait. Responding to the Prime Minister's comment, Conservative Chairman Kevin Holenrake said Kerr Starmer's says he wants resilience and energy security. So why is he banning North Sea drilling and ducking welfare reform? You cannot build a resilient economy by turning your back on British oil and gas workers, handing energy dependence to foreign states, and leaving millions trapped on benefits rather than work. End quote. Liberal Democrat Foreign Affairs spokesperson Callum Miller said the Prime Minister is right that we must increase our resilience, but he cannot achieve that if he won't name the greatest strategic challenge we face. It's clear we can't trust a Trump-led America anymore, and the government should be doing everything it can to rebuild ties with our closest allies in Europe. A spokesperson for the Reform UK said, quote, if we don't want to be at the mercy of foreign global crisis, the answer is obvious. Use our own energy, control our own borders, and put the British people first, end quote. The Green Party leader, Zach Polensky, said, quote, Starmer is finally waking up to the reality Greens have been raising for years and been attacked by him for. We cannot rely on the U.S. for security. We need European security partnerships, end quote. And yes, we must end fossil fuel dependence, but Starmer's words are not a plan. Energy bills are soaring. The gap between rich and poor grows, And this government tinkers at the edges, Polanski added. Next, also from the UK. UK says Russia ran submarine operation over cables and pipelines. Three Russian submarines conducted a covert operation over cables and pipelines in the waters north of the UK, Defense Secretary John Healey said. A British warship and aircraft were deployed to deter the, quote, malign activity of Moscow, and there was no evidence of any damage to UK infrastructure in the Atlantic, he added. Addressing Russian President Vladimir Putin directly, Healey said, "We see you. We see your activity over our cables and pipelines, and you should know that any attempt to damage them will not be tolerated and will have serious consequences." The Russian embassy in London has denied Healey's claims, according to Moscow's state news agency, TASC. The UK is dependent on its undersea cables and pipelines for its data and energy. There are around 60 undersea cables which come ashore at several points along the UK coastline, particularly around East Anglia and Southwest England. More than 90% of the UK's day-to-day internet traffic travels via these undersea cables. Moving on to Africa, the first headline. Fears over West Africa's Islamic insurgency dominate Benin's election campaign. With growing fears that the militant Islamic insurgency that has engulfed large parts of West Africa is spreading, security has been dominating the campaign trail in Benin, a once largely peaceful nation. Sunday's presidential election comes about 4 months after outgoing President Patrice Talon survived a coup attempt when Nigeria, the regional superpower, sent warplanes to bombard mutinous soldiers who had attempted to overthrow him. Nigeria's intervention prevented Benin from going down the path of several other regional states, including Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali, where the military seized power in recent years as disillusionment grew over the failure of civilian governments to beat back the militants allied with Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State group. The threat posed to Benin by the insurgents was highlighted by the fact that an Al-Qaeda affiliate known by the initials JNIM killed 15 soldiers last month in an attack on a military base near the border with Niger. It signaled a continuation of a trend witnessed last year when 28 Benin soldiers were killed in January in an attack in the West National Park, which stretches into Niger and Burkina Faso. And another 54 3 months later in the same park, making it the highest death toll suffered by the military at the hands of insurgents. West National Park and two adjacent areas, Penjari and Arli, are the largest protected wilderness areas in West Africa, covering 1.7 million hectares. The forests are dense and the region's porous borders make it easy for militants to set up bases and to move across countries without being detected by the security forces. As attacks intensified, at least 1,000 people were killed in these border areas in 2025, more than double the number from 2024. The attacks have alarmed locals, with a school teacher telling the BBC, "We only want to work to educate the youth. It is becoming so difficult. We can't imagine our country becoming like Nigeria with Boko Haram threats, which has killed so many people." Expressing her fears, a mother of one said, "We are afraid to go into the fields. We don't know what to do, where to go, anytime. Those guys could come here and rape us, steal our stuff, or kill us. It's not easy. Benin doesn't deserve this. The youth don't deserve this." Regardless of who wins the election on Sunday, most people in Benin expect a smooth transition of power and hope that the next leader will have greater success in improving relations with neighboring states and containing the insurgency that have caused havoc in the region. Let's move on to Asia. This one kind of crosses between Asia and the Middle East. Ceasefire or no ceasefire, the Middle East's reshuffling is not done yet. The best hope for a ceasefire talks in Pakistan is that both the United States and Iran have strong reasons to call a halt to the war. The biggest obstacle to their success is a total absence of trust, no discernible common ground, and the fact that Israel, America's full partner in the war, has hugely escalated its onslaught on Lebanon. U.S. President Donald Trump is already speaking about the war in the past tense. He has declared victory and needs an exit. Not only does he have a state visit from King Charles in the diary for later this month, followed by a summit with China's President Xi Jinping in May, there are midterm elections in November. With America's summer holiday season looming, Trump also needs petrol prices to fall back to where they were before he went to war. Royal visits, summits, and elections do not mix well with war. Iran's regime has its own reasons to end the war. It is as defiant as ever, still able to launch missiles and drones, with its social media warriors poring over AI videos lampooning Donald Trump. But Iran has suffered massive damage. Cities have come under economic standstill, and the regime needs time to regroup and will try to use the talks in Pakistan to strengthen its position. The Pakistani intermediaries, who will be shuttling between the two delegations, have a tough job on their hands. The declared positions of the two sides are as far apart as it is possible to be. Trump has a 15-point plan that has not been published, but leaked versions make it sound more like a surrender document than a basis for negotiation. Iran's 10-point plan contains a list of demands that America has consistently rejected in the past. Creating a more durable ceasefire will require some kind of agreement to at least keep talking, about the two sides' contradictory lists of intractable issues. It would be hard to work through them in peacetime. In wartime, without any kind of mutual trust, even a form of words that keep the ceasefire going, irrespective of there being no agreement on wider issues, will look positive. No agreement on at all points towards a road back to war. The newest and most urgent problem they face concerns reopening the Strait of Hormuz. The narrow exit from the Gulf, keeping it closed, gives Iran a chokehold on the world economy. Reopening the waterway that was used by hundreds of ships a day until the U.S. and Israel attacked Iran has become a central issue in the negotiation. The millions of civilians in the Middle East who have been caught up in this conflict hope this negotiation will be the war's endgame. The Americans did not expect to be spending early April sitting down to ceasefire talks when, alongside Israel on February 28th, they ignited the war with huge strikes that killed, among many others, Iranian Supreme Leader, his wife, and other members of their family. Trump was expecting a quick victory, an Iranian version of the U.S. military's stunning kidnap of the Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro and his wife in January. Both are on trial in New York on narco-terrorism charges, and the U.S. has installed his former deputy in the presidential palace. It should not have been a surprise that Iran blocked the strait when it was attacked. Iran has threatened to do so in the past and disrupted oil shipments there during the war with Iraq in the first years of the Islamic Republic in the 1980s. The ability to stop shipping using one of the world's most important trading arteries is a potent weapon that Iran wants to turn into a long-term strategic gain. Alongside demands for the closure of U.S. bases in the region, for the reparations for war damage, the return to the enrichment of uranium, and the lifting of sanctions, Iran wants to institutionalize its control of the strait. During the two-week ceasefire already agreed, Iran is insisting that any ship that wants to transit the Strait of Hormuz will need the permission of Iran's armed forces or it will be attacked and destroyed. It has charged some of the new vessels, the few vessels that have been allowed through, millions of dollars in tolls. If that continues, it would be able to raise billions, a prospect that horrifies Gulf Arab states. The long-term consequences of the war will reverberate across the Middle East and beyond. The wealthy Arab monarchies of the Gulf have spent years and billions on turning themselves into global hubs for business, tourism, and air travel. A few weeks of Iranian attacks have done lasting damage to that strategy for modernization and development. They have also been reassessing their alliances with the U.S. They will not break with Washington. They need Americans too much. But they are looking to diversify their future security. The old model of getting as close as possible to the U.S. has not worked. China is also watching closely. So is Russia, as Trump once again threatens NATO allies he claims were not there when America needed them. China pushed the Iranians to agree to the ceasefire and is likely to keep pushing to keep them talking. It relies on Middle Eastern oil. Iran has let its own tankers heading to China through the Strait of Hormuz, but it will also be ready to exploit any gaps left by Trump's haphazard foreign policy. And what about the people of Iran? They are cut off behind an internet blackout imposed by the regime. After weeks of airstrikes, death, and fear, whatever their views of the regime are unknown. On the 28th of February, Trump and Netanyahu promised the regime's opponents a chance to take back the country. That has been forgotten. Moving on to Europe. Russia and Ukraine agree to an Orthodox Easter truce. Russia and Ukraine have agreed to a truce for Orthodox Easter, with Vladimir Putin saying he's ordered the troops to cease fire in all directions this weekend. His declaration came after President Zelensky issued repeated calls for a ceasefire, all ignored by the Kremlin. Putin said the Russian truce would run from 1600 local time on Saturday through the 11th of April through Easter Sunday, adding that he expected Ukraine to follow the example of Russia. He ordered his forces to be ready to intercept any possible enemy provocations and any aggressive actions. Russia's tone and the attempt to steal the initiative will make Ukrainians bristle. But Zelensky soon posted on X that Ukraine was ready for symmetrical steps. People need a holiday free from threats and real movement towards peace, he wrote. Russia has a chance not to return to strikes after Easter as well. Next, EU fingerprint and photo travel rules come into force. The EU's new digital border system, which requires fingerprints and photographs alongside a passport scan, is set to be fully operational from Friday. This was the deadline for the entry/exit system, the EES, to be activated at every Schengen border crossing point in all 29 participating countries. The system is being gradually introduced from October to strengthen security and ultimately make travel smoother, though due to some hiccups, not every point will be fully rolling it out. There have been long queues at some European airports and warnings that delays could be worse during busy holiday periods. The EES system is a digital system designed to keep track of when non-EU citizens, including those from the UK, enter and leave Schengen areas. This covers 29 European countries, mainly in the EU, which people can travel across without border controls. It includes many popular destinations for UK travelers, such as France, Spain, Portugal, Italy, and Greece. Under the new system, fingerprints and a photo have to be registered. EES will eventually replace the current system of passports being stamped by a border officer. And finally, we continue with our article about how bad smells affect your health. Smell has partly evolved into an early warning signal to help us avoid getting ill or infected. Something that smells rancid is likely to be packed with bacteria looking to do us harm. As such, it is part of our so-called behavioral immune system. The olfactory system primarily functions as a avoiding system to learn to warn us about dangers in the environment. Work has even shown that odor signals are processed in the brain within about 300 milliseconds of being inhaled through the nose. Study participants exposed to bad smells showed a rapid physical response, instinctively withdrawing from the source of the smell. When a smell is associated with a threat, our sensitivity to it can also increase dramatically. In one study, Professor Lindstrom and his colleagues showed that pairing a smell with an electric shock can make people detect an odor at much lower concentrations, a response that likely evolved to help humans react quickly to potential dangers, even when the smells are only faint. Similarly, the rotten egg scent of hydrogen sulfide, a gas produced in sewage processing, can be perceived in concentrations as low as 0.5 parts per billion, an alarm bell for the gas that is lethal in higher concentrations. Smell isn't just about threat detection. Odors can have very real effects on people's health and well-being. Scientists have shown that good smells, like a fragrance of a woodland, can be beneficial for your mental health, partly because they stimulate brain regions linked to emotion and memory. Well, next week we'll get into more of this article, but for today, we're out of time. I guess I should have timed it better. Well, have a great weekend, and if you're Greek Orthodox, have a great Easter. So we'll be back next week with more news from the BBC.